Part 1, celebrating the legendary Pinehurst.
This is Golf Smarter. Each week, we tap the minds of PGA and USGA course pros, architects, authors, and teaching gurus to provide you with tips, drills, insights, and advice so that you can lower your scores. Golf Smarter is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us. You and I have had this ongoing debate about the importance of doing episodes on specific courses. You say, I'll never play there. And I say, learning about a designer's tendencies and getting instruction from PGA professionals about how to read the features of a course can only help improve your game and your golf IQ. But what about those courses you may never play but really want to? If I did a show about Augusta National or San Francisco's Olympic Club, I'm sure you'd show some interest. But the likelihood of ever playing those private courses is far less than taking a business or pleasure trip to Palm Springs and playing the Gary Player's signature course at the Westin Mission Hills, which we covered a couple weeks ago. But today, all that changes. Because one of golf's most historic, decorated, and important destinations in the United States is nestled among the sand hills of North Carolina, Pinehurst. More championships have been played at Pinehurst than any other course in America. The USGA Executive Director, David Fay, once said, I can't imagine anywhere in America better suited to serving as a home for golf than Pinehurst. The whole place just exudes golf. So it's a real coup for this little podcast to speak with today's guest. Eric Alpenfels is the Director of Golf Course Instruction and the Golf Advantage School at Pinehurst. He's written a variety of articles for Golf Magazine, Golf Tips, Private Club, Senior Golfer, and Golf for Women. And of course, you can get more information at Pinehurst.com. So it's with great excitement and anticipation that I say, welcome, Eric.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a delight to have you here because we all know Pinehurst, but why do we all know Pinehurst? What's so special about Pinehurst?
Ooh, that is a good question because I've been here about 23 years now, and I think...
And you're jaded.
Yeah, I'm a little biased. I guess the joke around here is nobody else would hire me, but that's another story. But... I think that Pinehurst is a facility that has changed with the times, and yet at the same time, when you're walking around the clubhouse, you realize you're walking on the same steps and the same brick pavers that literally every great golfer who's ever played the game probably has walked on at some point in their career. And that's what's kind of neat about it, that it's modern, yet at the same time it has the rich history that a facility could have. So it's pretty neat.
That's amazing. And the history really goes back quite a ways.
Yeah, actually, the Tufts family was really pretty amazing. Either they were the luckiest people in the world, or they just really had a lot of insight into what they were trying to get done, and they really saw the future that Pinehurst could have. I mean, to think that they hired Donald Ross to be the first golf professional and to design some courses, and then they at the same time hired Frederick Law Olmsted to come in and design the grounds of the village. I mean, here you've hired two of the greatest people in their fields that we've probably ever seen, really. So it's pretty amazing.
So really, I thought Donald Ross was hired as the architect. He was hired as the head professional?
Oh, yeah, he was the first golf professional here, yeah.
Oh.
Well, and certainly dual roles, but to think that they brought a guy in that had that experience level in both fields, not only as a golf professional, but also... as a golf course architect, and to head up the golf operations. Pretty amazing.
That's really amazing. So is Pinehurst the city, or is it the village? What is Pinehurst?
Well, it's probably, in my definition, it's a little bit of both. It's not only the resort, but it also is the village of Pinehurst, a small town, very New Englandish in style, rounded streets. I mean, from a standpoint, that's where the Olmsted design comes into play, that it's all circular. You'll remember his name from Central Park in New York City and such. And so it's very quaint, wonderful old homes. And from the core of the village, it circles out and spreads out, and then you get to the golf courses and the hotels, the Pinehurst hotels.
And it's not like the awards have been lavished over just the golf course. I mean, the spa, I mean, when I was looking through your website, I was seeing that it's the spa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a wonderful spa. We have a great tennis facility, obviously the golf. There's just a whole lot of things to do here. I mean, as far as if you're looking outside of the realm of golf and you've got family members that want to do different things, there's certainly lots of different things to do at Pinehurst.
And is it Mecca? Is it golf Mecca?
Well, now this is where I'll be biased because I think it is. I mean, it's from a standpoint of you've got golf courses that bring to the golfer different challenge levels. We have some golf courses that, by design, when they were built, are relatively short by modern standards. I mean, but at the same time, you wouldn't want to go out there and have to shoot your handicap on any given day, because they're pretty tough, even though they're relatively short yardage-wise. Then, of course, we've got course number four, which was redone in 1998-99 by the Fazio Group, and we've got course six and course eight and certainly course seven and course number two. And, you know, we've got some championship courses that really can play as tough as you want them. Pretty challenging. So what I like about it is that you could come out here with a junior golfer that's a child maybe under the age of 12 or 10 or 8 or 6 and just kind of getting their feet wet with golf and take them out on the golf course, and they can be challenged from the tees that they want to play. And yet at the same time, you can go out on a different golf course or even that same golf course, play it all the way back, and get all the game you want.
So there's 8 golf courses.
Yes.
And they're all 18-hole courses?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And they're all championship courses.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Are there other golf courses in the neighborhood, or is that it?
Well, no, we've got, in our county itself, I should know how many exactly, but there's got to be 48 to 50 golf courses in Moore County, which is where Pinehurst is located.
And you are the anchor attraction, so everybody's busy.
Well, me personally, yeah, I am the anchor. Yeah, Pinehurst is certainly the anchor. Our county is rich in golf, and there's wonderful facilities. Just down the road, there's Pine Needles, which is a great golf course, which is hosting the Women's U.S. Open coming up. And just a lot of history here in general with the golf.
Well, we're going to go over some of those courses, not obviously do shot-by-shot guide or a tee-tour on all the courses. And we're going to do another show where we just talk about Pinehurst Number 2, because the history is so rich with Pinehurst Number 2.
Sure.
But today, let's start with the Golf Advantage School, which is under your purview, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Tell me why the Golf Advantage School is ranked so high and what is so special about it.
Primarily, our focus has been in the development of our short game and our full swing practice areas. We've got 3 greens that we focus on short game. We have a large tee box that allows us lots of room to do full swing practice. And certainly along with that is the hotel. I mean, not taking that out, but probably from a standpoint of the facility, it's really pretty remarkable. It's pretty hard to find a facility that has this much space and the focus on how to practice and lots of room to work on your game in different environments or different situations. You know, for example, around our short game greens, we've created uneven lies and pop bunkers and things that really will make it difficult for you to hit a shot. I mean, it's not just an easy little shot that you can rehearse over and over, and then you go out on the golf course and face something that's really difficult, and you don't know how to practice it, or you don't know how to hit it. You know, you will have had plenty of opportunity to work on your game. We call it situational practice, where we put the golfers in these situations that they'll face out on the course. So we spend a lot of time developing that type of facility.
You talked about how to practice.
Mm-hmm.
That's an intriguing thought. Tell me what that means.
Well, I would say that, and if you're not familiar with some of the stuff that we've done, for the last 3 years now, we've really tried to focus in on what's the best way to practice to help you improve your performance out on the golf course. You know, over the last years, there's just been so much information on where the golf club should be, what the club face should be like in the backswing and swing planes. And, you know, we know so much about a golf swing, it's really incredible. You know, what the body does, what the shaft does, what the club face does. I mean, there's been thousands of hours of research done on what you're supposed to do with the golf club. But very little research has ever been done on how do you practice to maybe enhance your performance out on the golf course. And so being Pinehurst and kind of being rich in this history of trying to be innovative in things, we decided a few years ago that maybe we should go in the direction of helping people learn how to practice and put themselves in a position where they can actually expect to perform better out on the golf course. And so yeah, you might have seen some of our stuff in Golf Magazine, let's say, over the last few years where we've tested a drill maybe that is designed to influence the club face at impact. So we'll test, you know, 6 or 9 ways to cure a slice, and then we'll present that to Golf Magazine. But other things that we've been doing are how to improve the transfer skill from the driving range to the golf course. You know, the old line that the longest walk in golf is from the range to the first tee, and it's, you know, kind of true with the golfers we encounter, is that you can make some swing changes on the range, but it's really difficult to carry those changes out to performance. And we've been trying to figure out ways to make somebody play better or perform better out on the golf course.
Is there a difference between warming up and practicing?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, as far as folks that study, you know, the biomechanics of it would say that, you know, warming up before you go play really is just a function of warming up and just getting yourself loose so you, if you have potential injuries, you reduce those risks, or at least getting loosened up to where you can get out there and make a full swing and expect to get some results. Where practice is really the idea of transferring a learned skill into the motion. So yeah, there's a big difference, and I think sometimes people confuse that. I mean, they'll go out and practice before they go play 18 holes, and you know, they'll practice for an hour, maybe start hitting some shots pretty decent out on the range, but then they expect that to transfer out to the golf course, and that's a big leap.
Why?
That's a tough step. Well, it's just they practice in a way that does not allow them to really get results out on the golf course. Well, for example, I'll give you maybe a quick example of what I saw today. Watched a couple guys warm up today, and again, in their minds, they were warming up, but really they were practicing. They stood there for about 15 minutes and hit drivers. And
I'm sorry.
Well, no, it's just, you know, they stand there and they hit driver, and the first one slices, and the next one gets pulled left, and they're trying to be target oriented, so they're, you know, aiming for a flag out there on the range, and we have a kind of a makeshift. When you stand on the tee box and look down the range, you can kind of see how we've got some fairways kind of created in the range area where the ball would land and things. So you'd look at it and say, oh, okay, that's a little fairway there, and I'm going to try to hit my shot in there. And you know, they stand there for 15, 20 minutes with a driver, and really all they're doing is they're just rehearsing, or they're just trying to get the club face squared up enough to get the ball flying straight. So by the time they're done, they've got 18 different swing thoughts, and they finally get a little bit of rhythm and hit a couple straight ones. They go to the first tee box, and now it's a, you know, it's the first hole of number 4, which is a tee shot that is to a plateaued area. There's a pop bunker, two, three pop bunkers on the right-hand side. There's a waste area to the left. And now they don't have 18 swings at it. They've got one. Mm-hmm. And so they've spent all this time trying to, you know, makeshift this golf swing that just they don't have time to fix it in that short amount of time, is all I'm saying. So they really didn't warm up very correctly. And also they really didn't give themselves a chance to ingrain something that maybe would make the ball fly straighter.
And do you think they were really trying to see, I mean, if they're out there together, do you think they were really trying to see if it was going to go straight or who can hit it the farthest?
Well, yeah, probably. It was a little bit of both.
I mean, you got to, I have to believe that you walk out there and you've been doing this long enough where you don't get involved, but you stand back and just shake your head saying, you know, come on, you don't just walk out, grab your driver and start hitting the ball.
Yeah, well, then, yeah, and yet they do. It's amazing. Yeah, they go whack it out there. And the thing is that if, and kind of back to what we've been trying to do with our research and just our efforts is to, what can you do to help somebody realize that those steps they're taking really aren't going to be the most effective? And more importantly, what can we study and present to folks and say, listen, we've tested 6 different ways to use a drill. Let's say you want to make a swing change, and you know a certain drill is going to be effective in making that swing change. Well, how do you practice the drill to get the most out of your time? And see, nobody's ever done that, and that's what we're studying right now. Is there a sequence of practicing a drill that will guarantee that you'll make quicker swing changes from a pre to a post session let's say you put somebody on a launch monitor and they hit a couple, they hit 10 shots on a launch monitor, then you know they're kind of ball flight, and then you say, okay, we're going to give you this drill, and here's the way we want you to practice it, and when you post-test them, you can guarantee that they're going to see some improvement. And is there a way to practice a drill? Are different routines effective? And we're kind of exploring all those things right now and really finding that the way you practice is imperative. I guess it'd be like the old analogy that if you have a bottle of aspirin, you know, aspirin by design should be pretty good for a headache, but you only take two or three every 6 hours or whatever the directions are. And that seems to be the right amount that solves the issue. Well, if you take the whole bottle, it's not so good. And if you only take one, that's not so good. So kind of like a drill or a teaching aid or whatever, or a swing thought for that matter, how would you practice it to get the most result or to get the best result out of what you're trying to do? And that's what we're exploring.
What is the most common mistake that you see when people come? Because I guess as a destination resort, people don't come out there to practice, you know, on a daily basis. They come out, warm up, and go out and play golf.
Yeah, they're ready to go play, sure.
Yeah, exactly. So what is the most common mistake that you see in the warm-up session?
I would say that they don't practice, or they don't warm up, rather, in a way that prepares them for the golf course. Again, kind of back to those guys that were just hitting the drivers, you know, just ripping drivers.
Right.
That every accomplished player I've ever watched warm up, you know, they certainly have a frame of just hitting some shots just to get loosened up and trying to change the trajectories or whatever they're working on. But then at some point they shift into more the mode of how are they going to play. You know, for example, the first hole on that fourth course, course number four, first hole, really isn't necessarily a driver hole. You know, you could probably hit a driver, but you'd probably be better off hitting a three-wood. So the golfer that's preparing to go play and really getting themselves in the mind frame of playing would probably hit, maybe play the first couple holes of course four on the driving range. So they'd hit a three-wood off the tee, and if they hit it solid, they'll have about a 7-iron into the green or a 6-iron, something like that. So they might hit a 6-iron to a different target that's kind of going in a different direction, and then maybe hit a little pitch shot because they'll pretend they missed the green short left or something. And then the next hole is a par 5 straight away, and so you want to rip a driver. So then they would set themselves up to hit a driver and maybe, again, change the direction that they're hitting the ball in, again, to kind of reflect a little bit of that change that you'd see out on the golf course. And they really kind of set the tone for play, where if you just hit a bunch of drivers and you're working on just trying to hit it straight, that's fine, but really you're not really preparing to go out on the golf course. And so, you know, the old thing of it, we always hear the students say, well, you know, it takes me about four holes to get warmed up. Then the question is, well, don't you hit balls on the range? Well, yeah, I hit a bunch of balls on the range, but it always takes me like four or five holes to kind of get in the rhythm of playing. Well, these, you know, accomplished players do that on the range. They get into that rhythm of playing. They hit a shot off the tee, that imaginary tee off the range, and they stand around for a couple seconds and talk to their buddy and then kind of do a couple practice swings and say, okay, now I'm going to hit a 6-iron into that target. So they kind of even set the pace of it, not only from the standpoint of the mind frame, but also just the speed of how quickly they're hitting shots.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's back to what you were referring to earlier of situational practice.
Yeah.
As opposed to pulling out your 6-iron and hitting 6 shots in a row without even, you know, like lining up the ball or doing your little pre-shot routine, just whack.
Well, and it kind of depends on what you're trying to get done. Now, if you're in a... See, there's different modes of practice. Let's say you break them into kind of traditional practice and then transfer practice. Transfer practice would be what we were just talking about, you know, hitting out on the range and hitting a shot and then saying, okay, that would leave me an 8-iron into the screen, or kind of playing situational shots. That would be transfer, because that's transferring you to the golf course. Even though you're not on the golf course, you're getting in that mode. Traditional practice, or sometimes referred to as block practice, would be where you're standing there with a 6-iron, a shaft on the ground, working on your takeaway. That's fine. You know, that's the only way you're going to make any swing changes is by some practice. But at the same time, would you want to do that before you go play? Yeah, it's going to be tough to get that to transfer out. So block practice or traditional practice is great if you're working on a swing change, but you don't practice the swing change 5 minutes before you go out onto a golf course. It's just tough you just don't get any results. It's just tough to get results.
Are you suggesting that maybe we should go out with either the scorecard or the yardage book to the driving range?
Oh, absolutely. I would, uh, I, I would encourage people to distinguish what kind of environment they're going to be in. Are they going to be in a traditional practice or a block practice mode for an hour and a half and hit some balls and work on their swing? Or are they going to be trying to work on shaping shots and kind of preparing themselves for the golf course they're going to play the next day? And if that's the case, then, yeah, have the scorecard in your pocket or the yardage book in your pocket and hit a shot off the first tee box of course number 8. Great little par 4. You can make a 10 on it if you're not careful. And you stand there, and it's a narrow fairway. You got the driving range on your right. It kind of slopes off to the left. You've got about 220 yards to a fairway bunker on the left-hand side that's way too deep to hit into, and you want to avoid that if at all cost. And you know, you hit that 3-wood off that tee box, and then hit a little 9-iron in that green. And so you should play that hole 2 or 3 times before you ever get up onto that tee box.
Before we start talking about the courses, tell me your favorite warm-up drill.
Well, my favorite one I've ever seen was John Daly. I thought it was just beautiful. He was here in the, I guess it was probably the 91 Tour Championship. And, you know, it was back when he was really the guy who could move a golf ball. So we watched his caddy carry his bag up to the tee box and tee up a driver and walk back and stand with him underneath the bleachers that were overlooking the range, and people were chanting his name because they wanted to see this guy hit drivers. So, you know, you would kind of think the guy would make a couple practice swings or something. So he walked up to that driver and to that ball teed up, pulled out a driver, and just hit the prettiest drive you've ever seen. They had to go 340 yards.
Wow.
Walked back underneath the bleachers, smoked a cigarette, was talking to his caddy. People chanted his name again. Caddy went out there, teed up a ball. Did the same thing, hit a driver about 340 yards, said, I'm loosened up, let's go to the putting green. So that was beautiful. He was hysterical. And that's the way he warmed up. Now, I just don't know.
Please, you're not recommending that, I hope.
Well, yeah, I think he had about 10 cigarettes in the same time period. But it was kind of that. How could anybody really do that on a regular basis? But that was always fun to watch. I think probably the
come on, you're talking to hacks now. Come on.
Yeah. Well, I think probably the my favorite routine to follow, if someone were to just go out and play any of our courses, or just being at home and going out to play on a Saturday morning, would give yourself plenty of time. If it takes you, if you want to get there an hour before your tee time and just have a nice, easy pace and drink a cup of coffee or a cup of juice and just hit a few shots on the range and get loosened up. But really, my recommendation would always be, the better players I've seen warm up before they go play or get prepared to go play, they're not rushing around. They're not working on their golf swing a whole bunch. They're really trying to get a feel of what the swing's going to be like out on the golf course, and kind of that sense of how solid the shots are going to be, or if the ball's leaking a little bit right or curving a little left, they'll just make a slight adjustment in their alignment for the day and then give themselves some time at a later date to go out and practice. But if you're going to go out and play, just hit a couple shots to loosen up, get yourself warmed up, your body warmed up, and really kind of minimize some of the swing thoughts and really think in terms of, back to what we were talking about earlier, maybe playing the first couple holes on the range and get kind of prepared to go play. And actually what you'll find is it's really hard to do. It's a lot easier just to stand there and rip drivers. But the trouble is you just don't stand there and rip drivers out on the golf course. You actually...
Played with me.
Well, a couple guys I've seen, I guess could hit 18 drivers in a row. It's
just, just bring a lot of balls with you.
Just bring a lot of golf balls, yeah. That's good, though.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That was actually very good. Let's talk now about the various golf courses at Pinehurst. Mm-hmm. And let's start with number one. Why don't you give us a little background, a little overview of the course?
Well, course number one is a great golf course that we use quite often with our Golf Advantage schools. We'll take our students out to the course, and it's really a great golf course to do on-course instruction. It's challenging. It has a lot of, you have to play a lot of different shots out there. You can hit a driver off the first tee and a driver off the second tee, but then on the third tee box, you're probably going to really need to hit a 3-wood or possibly a long iron or a utility club if you can hit it far enough, because it's a sharp dog leg right, and you're really just hitting a driver just as you just hit it into the woods. So it's kind of one of those courses where it kind of meanders through the area. And it just has a great kind of old-school style to it. Classic kind of Donald Ross, you know, where you'll play a 330-yard par 4, sharp, you know, dogleg right par 4, but the hole before it would be a 440-yard par 4 straight away, you know, just stuff like that. And neat little Ross construction around the greens, this style, you know, undulations and such. And it's just it's a fun little golf course. And yet it's not one of those golf courses where that's every hole's, you know, paralleled by water hazards and stuff like that. You can lose a golf ball, but it's not one that you can hit it just down the right side of the fairway and trickles into a pond or something like that, like some courses we've all been on.
Hmm.
But it's a lot of fun. It's a great golf course.
What defines the Donald Ross course?
Because
you say he's got, you know, it's like a Donald Ross course. Well, what does that mean?
Well, I'm going to have a hard time answering that because there's just some nuances to his stuff that I've always appreciated. You know, just kind of that distance of one par four followed up by another par four that's 100 yards short, and yet it's just as hard of a par four.
Hmm.
It's still a tough par four, but instead of being 430 or 440, it's 340 sharp dogleg right, and you can still make a seven on it and really wonder what in the world happened.
But you can go out onto a course and like, oh my God, this is so Donald Ross.
Yeah, the green complexes always to me are what stand out. From a standpoint of the undulations, the catch basins, and by that meaning an area where if the ball rolls off the putting surface, how quickly it can gather speed, and you know you're standing there in the fairway thinking, well, that should be on the, you know, that'll be 5 feet off the edge of the green, and then when you actually get to it, it's 45 feet off the edge of the green because it trickled down a hill and stuff like that. That's always kind of to me a little style of Donald Ross, and yet some of the things that he does off the fairway where, you know, the old classic, it's a straightaway par four, but you have to be on the left side of the fairway to really have a good shot at the pin.
So it's been around, but his design still holds up quite well.
Yeah, it does. Now, again, the thing that has changed some of his courses, not only here, but also certainly we've all seen courses around the country that are a little bit less like they used to be because of the distance people can propel a golf ball.
Right.
I mean, anymore they can just hit it so far.
And do any of the Pinehurst courses reflect that?
Courses 1 and 3 are courses that have not been lengthened to meet those demands, really. And a lot of it's because of the land. There's just no place really to expand them. And yet at the same time, the average golfer really can go out there and have a good time.
All right, we'll do our next show we'll do on number 2. But number 3, you were saying it's a shorter course?
Yeah, just a little shorter. It's mm-hmm. kind of like course number 1.
Also a Donald Ross design?
Donald Ross design, yeah. Mm-hmm. Again, what I like about course number 3 is what's fun about it. Again, we do a lot of on-course out there with our students. It's a great golf course because it's, again, not the length of other courses like number 2. But I tell you what, you might hit a 3-wood off a couple of tee boxes and only have an 8-iron in, but the greens are small. There's lots of undulations to them, characteristics of number 2, and they're fast. And I tell you what, if you miss the green by a couple of feet, you'll still be 45 feet off the edge of the putting surface because you landed in the wrong spot, just like on number 2. Course number 3 to me always was it always seems like a golf course that Ross designed to match up with a morning round on number 2. You know, just not as long, but you better have your short game in check because you'll get some long putts that have double breaks or triple breaks, and you'll have some chip shots that are up and over a ridge that will be downhill to the pin. Just a great little challenging, certainly on your short game and short irons into the greens.
Now, I was intrigued by looking through the website again. I was saying number 5 was designed, it says, in 1961. Number 6 designed in 79. Number 7 in 86. Number 8 in 96. And yet number 4, it's credited as a Tom Fazio course in 2000.
Yeah, we.
How's that work?
Well, it was some of the thought process was with the Open coming in 99, we had the opportunity to renovate course number 4. And if we were going to renovate course number 4, we really needed to do it in that time period. Some of course number 4 during the 99 Open was utilized for the corporate village. I mean, we had in on the, I guess, what would have been the old 8th fairway was where the network compound was for television. So it was kind of one of those situations where it was a good opportunity to take a golf course that needed a bit of a facelift and do some work on it and time it with the Open, to where as the Open was drawing nearer and the space allocation was needed for the corporate village, we could have a golf course that was just about done renovation-wise. We could use those areas that we needed to use, and then once the Open cleared out, we could sod those areas and very quickly open the golf course, and it's a wonderful track. It's a great golf course. In fact, it'll be the qualifying course for the 2008 U.S. Amateur.
Oh, all right. And when Fazio designs this, and then you have Ellis Maples doing design, George and Tom Fazio coming together for a design on number 6, Reese Jones, do they do their design in reverence to Donald Ross, or do you think that they're like, this is my canvas, I want to do it the way I want?
You know, that's a good question. I would say that certainly with 6 and 4, I think someone could walk out there and see a lot of similarities to the green complexes of number 2. And I think they would even see some of the tee box angles and the way a hole is shaped, where they obviously move some ground, but they kind of shaped it a little bit characteristic of a Donald Ross. And I would have to think that that's somewhat in the reverence of Ross and his skill as an architect. And I guess too that it's really kind of, you know, almost by design, these guys have shifted back to more the traditional of utilizing the lay of the ground and not really having to move a whole bunch of dirt to make a statement. Certainly some architects, you know, go in and just move just countless truckloads of dirt to make it have a certain look to it, where our terrain is naturally rolling. There's natural slopes. I mean, there's natural hills that you really don't have to create, that if you just kind of weave the golf course in and through it, you really get some nice a nice look to it without having to do a whole lot of work.
And do you think that that's done with strategy in mind or visuals in mind? More of like, oh, we can make this really long, and we can put this right in the way. And
you know, I don't know. I don't know. I don't have that skill that those guys do, so I don't know how they do it.
Mm-hmm.
They're just. I mean, sometimes you would see a Fazio out there kind of moving his arms a little bit, and the guy's nodding his head about where he's going to do shape a little dirt here and there, and it was wonderful. Once they got done, it's like, wow, how'd they see that? I don't know how they do that.
That's why you're teaching.
yeah, that's true there. I don't think anybody would want me to have anything to do with grass. Growing it, shaping it, anything.
Completely different beast.
Yeah, certainly.
Let's talk about number 5 for a second, because, again, it's the only one of the courses, of the 8 courses, that was designed by Ellis Maples, and everything else being either Donald Ross. It seems like Donald Ross or Fazio. And you also have Reese Jones on number 7. But what makes number 5 unique?
Well, you know, 5's a fun golf course that probably most golfers would say is one they're familiar with playing. It's, you know, it just kind of meanders its way through that part of our 10,000 acres of Pinehurst. And you know, it has some homes on it. It's more of certainly more of the courses that you would see at a country club. You know, the houses, there's some homes on the sides of the fairway, and there's roads that bisect the second green and the third tee box and things like that. But again, it kind of has that same Pinehurst kind of style to me, that, you know, the second tee box is elevated because it obviously the ground there, the terrain was a pretty big drop down, and they built a fairway in there, and then it slopes back up to the green. So it's a subtle dogleg right, left to right dogleg, but an elevation change that 40 feet off the tee, and then to a green that's probably elevated 20 feet, and you know, nothing scary, but at the same time, you're standing there with a 6 iron, and you're thinking, well, the wind's blowing in my face. I'm 160 60 yards away, you know, I might need to hit a five because I could be really 185 from the pin. And it's just that, again, the subtleties of that design that make it challenging. You know, I don't know about you, but a lot of the students I work with, they have a hard time standing there and adjusting for, you know, if it says 150, they think, oh, I should hit a 7-iron because that one time 10 years ago they hit a 7-iron 150 yards. And so now it's uphill into the wind and they're still thinking 7-iron and they really should be thinking 5-iron. And that's, again, kind of what's tricky about number five is there's some subtleties out there that really dictate different club selections, and there's lots of uneven lies that you can encounter out there, and it's a fun little course, too.
Is there a lot of elevation change throughout the course?
It, to me, there is, yeah. I mean, maybe somebody that's from different parts of the country would say, yeah, it's no big deal. But, I mean, to me, there's lots of elevation changes. For example, on the second hole, third hole, fourth hole has an elevated tee down to a valley that hits again up to a plateaued green. Then the fifth, sixth, seventh hole are pretty straight away from a standpoint of level. Eighth hole, again, drops a little bit, slopes right to left, but then it's pretty sharp dogleg right to left.
But enough elevation change that it's going to have an impact on which club you select.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I think, if you were someone who needs to work on adjusting to elevation controls or the effect of elevation on a shot, five would be a great golf course to go out on and just drop a ball at 150 yards and start training your eye on, okay, I'm 150 yards by yardage, but how much is the green being elevated 20 feet going to influence this shot? It would be a great place to go just practice.
Okay, Teach, tell give me a sense of how I'm supposed to look in my bag when I'm looking at I'm looking down the fairway and the green is above me. It's definitely above my head. How am I supposed to figure that into what I'm doing? Can you give us some sort of instruction on that?
Well, I think a lot of it's, that's a really good question, because it's some of it's instinctive or that gut feeling that I need to hit this club because of the situation I'm in. A lot of it's experience. I mean, if you've never had that situation, you've got to draw on something that would give you some insight into it. I mean, I don't know if there's a formula. Certainly, I've been.
But I would think that. Yeah. I'm sorry for interrupting, but I think that someone's going to look at the green that's above them, and they're not going to get there because they're going to take their normal 150 club, and they go, "Oh, I just didn't hit it well."
Yeah.
But that's not really the case, and they don't. It doesn't sink in. It's like, you know what? Oh, I'm supposed to hitting farther.
Added more to it. Yeah. You know, I don't know of a. I mean, I'm sure somebody who would listen to this say, "Oh, yeah, guy's a moron. All you got to do if it's 10 feet above your head, it's another club." I just don't know if there's a formula like that holds up for everybody. But
or if you're hitting a par three and it's down below you.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think a lot of it's the look of it. From a standpoint, if you're 150 yards, you know you're 150 yards. But if it's uphill with any type of incline, you should automatically shift to another club. So let's say, just for easy math, it's normally I hit a 7-iron from 150 yards, and it's a subtle uphill climb to the green, nothing spectacular, it's not that elevated above me, but I would probably be inclined to say, hey, shift to a 6-iron just because of that subtle uphill. If it's elevated any more than that, I might go two clubs. And very rarely do I see people error where they overclub in these situations. They always underclub to me. They always seem to underclub. And some of the holes I'm thinking of at number five, and this is kind of the beauty of the architect, is that most of the trouble is not at the back of the green, it's at the front of the green.
How so?
Because they know they're going to underclub. I mean, these guys automatically know they're going to, if they get an error, they're going to error short.
Right.
They don't error long.
And so what does the designer do?
He puts a pot bunker left-hand side of the second green on number five. Actually puts two or three over there. Jeez. And then the green's elevated, so if you hit it left, if you hit it short at all, it'll roll back. Or you might get lucky and actually hit the bunker, because then the ball won't roll back. And now you've got just kind of a pop bunker shot versus having a pitch shot to a green that's elevated 8 feet above you or 6 feet above you.
Awesome.
So, I mean, it's just, architects, they know what people are going to do instinctively.
Or they create it.
Yeah. Mess with your head.
Isn't that golf?
Yeah, pretty much.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
Really interesting. And please, can you come? I want to do, let's do another one. Let's just come back and do focus on number two, and not only just how to play it and the nuances, but I want stories. Tell me some great stories about what you've heard about number two. Can you do that?
Sure. Be happy to.
All right. Great.
Golf Smarter now presents Nick's Picks with Kenny Nicholson, sales manager for EdwinWattsGolf.com. Kenny keeps us up to date with reviews of new products and new product development. Nick's Picks is brought to you by Edwin Watts Golf, golf's most trusted retailer since 1968.
Hey, Kenny, how you doing?
Good, Fred. How are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine. Got an interesting email from Walter in Seattle, Washington. Thanks, Walter, for sending this and asking the question. He wants to know, what are the differences between the equipment that the pros use on tour and what we can buy?
That's funny. We get that question a lot also, and the answer to the question is none. There's absolutely no difference. The manufacturers don't make special clubs for pros that do different things that it does for the average golfer out there.
But when we talked a couple weeks back and you had your tour of McGregor, you talked about it being custom fit for that single player and that they hand grind those clubs.
Which is correct on some irons. They do some custom work for irons. They take basically a standard golf club, and then they you know, one pro might want a leading edge a little bit steeper, a little bit sharper than another player, what have you. And I talked about custom fit in that sense, but any customer out there or person out there looking for golf equipment can have that done for themselves also. You know, if a guy's 5'5", he's obviously going to need a club that's flatter and shorter than a guy that's 6 foot. That would be custom fit. You know, just like any pro out there that is shorter or taller is going to have some custom work done. So they don't use any different material or make a club special for a pro versus anything else. They do things different with weight and grinding on irons that fits the pro better. They've just been fit, just like you can go out and get fit by one of your local PGA professionals, and he might tell you, hey, you need a club plus a half an inch and 2 degrees upright, and that can be custom ordered right here through EdwinWattsGolf.com or our 800 number, and you know, usually ships within 24 to 48 hours, so you have a custom fit set of golf clubs. But material-wise is the big question. Do they get something special that we don't? And the answer to that is no.
They just know how to hit the ball better than
they. That's exactly correct. The best thing to do, like, well, all the pros, when they get fit for a driver, an iron, or anything like that, they usually get on a launch monitor, which can be done by anybody now. There's launch monitors readily available at most golf shops anywhere. And that is the key to everything right there, especially in drivers, because you want to have a certain launch angle, which is usually anywhere between 12 and 14 degrees, and you want to have a certain spin rate, which is anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 or 3,500 RPMs. That way you're not getting too much lift and backspin and things of that nature. The most important characteristic in a driver, to me personally, is the shaft, without a doubt. That's the engine that drives the machine. If you don't have the right shaft, if it's too whippy, has too low of a kick point, or not enough torque at the bottom, you're going to hook and slice, and the ball's going to balloon or stay too low. So the most important thing is the shaft and the golf club, in my opinion.
So then there really is a difference if you're buying straight off the shelf or if you have it custom made. Is there a huge difference in price if you have this stuff custom fit for yourself?
No. If you call me and say, hey, I need a golf set, 2 degrees flat, minus a half an inch, there is absolutely no extra charge for me to have that done through the manufacturer. Okay, they don't charge any extra. They actually just make it through either Works or their custom department and ship it out. Now, if you change shafts, if you go from a Dynamic Gold S300, which might be one company stock shaft, and you go with a Project X or a rifle, there might be a little bit of an upcharge there. But for the most part, if you stay with their stock stuff, there's no upcharge to do custom work at all. And most in most all drivers now, they have their stock shaft, and then they offer pretty much anything else, the UST V2, the NV65, the Graphloy Pro Launch, all those shafts, there's no upcharge for any of those anymore.
And when you're having your club fitted, and it's like if you're going to get fitted for a suit, you know, they're gonna make sure that it fits you perfectly. And if you go have your clubs fitted for yourself, how do you know what shaft that you want, or if the shaft that comes stock on those clubs are the right shafts for you?
Real quick on shafts, when the manufacturer makes a golf club, whether it's irons or drivers, they go to the shaft manufacturer and say, hey,
make a shaft for this golf club. Okay, then they take every manufacturer that made a shaft. They go to Iron Byron or a testing facility, and they test them. Whichever shaft performs best in that golf club is usually the one that they use as a stock shaft, whether it's Aldila's or True Tempers or you name it. That's the shaft that they normally use as their stock shaft. And it's the club that, or it's the shaft that performs best for that product. So anytime you deviate away from that, you risk the performance not being exactly the same as it was with their stock. Just because it says stock doesn't mean it's cheap. Their stock shafts usually are the best shaft for that golf club. But if you know you need something else other than that, then by all means, we can order it for you.
So there is absolutely no reason to not get yourself fitted for some clubs.
Usually not. I mean, it's
and so it's totally to your advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's if a club's not fitted correctly for you, mainly in irons, you know, if the heel's digging in too much, you're obviously going to hook the ball more. If the toe's digging in too much, you're obviously going to slice the ball more. Drivers, not so much lie angle bother, but I mean, it's extremely important to get fitted if you're of average or other than average height. You know, I say anything 5'7 to 6'1 is usually fairly average, and most of those guys can use standard. So, but if you have the opportunity to get fit, by all means, go out and get fit and get a set custom made for you.
Well, then I guess the one thing you want to avoid is the candy at the checkout line, which is when you're walking in your pro shop and they have some clubs sitting there and you're going, you know, I'm just not happy with my driver anymore, and you just pick up a driver and walk out. That's what you really should avoid.
Well, correct. Most pro shops have indoor facilities now where you can try to hit them and learn, but you need to have some type of an educated guess, not just a guess. You know, you got to do a little bit of research on it. Most people know what they play. So the worst thing to do is to just go in and say, that club looks good, I think it's going to perform well for me, because the chances are that's not going to happen.
Well, Walter, thanks so much for taking the initiative of asking this question. And we encourage all of you, if you have a question specifically about some retail opportunities or if you want to know about some clubs, write to me, fred@golfsmarterpodcast.com, and we'll ask Kenny. And Kenny will have the answer for us, and he's not going to try to sell you anything. He's going to try to educate you, and we appreciate that. And Kenny's going to try to give you something, because right now our drawing is for the
Cleveland Highbore driver.
And we've been getting an excellent response to that. And we have 1 week left. Next week we'll draw the name from the listeners that write in to pick me at golfsmarterpodcast.com for the Cleveland Highbore driver. And make sure you include your name and mailing address so that we know where we can send your prize. And we'll have a drawing on November 14th, 2006. So the deadline for entries is November 13th. And also want to remind you of our November shopping special, which is anything that you purchase, any order over $50, you're going to receive a Premier Soft Cabretta leather glove. And it's any size for left or right hand. Kenny, thanks so much. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you, friend. Take care.
All right, buddy. That's Kenny Nicholson of Edwin Watts Golf. And please go to golfsmarterpodcast.com and click on the Edwin Watts Golf banner at the top of the page. And to ensure that the Golf Smarter podcast continues, we'd really appreciate if you could support our sponsors so they will continue to support us. As a listener to the Golf Smarter podcast, it's clear that you're interested in moving your game to the next level. So when your game deserves the very best personalized instruction, there's only one choice, the Bird Golf Academy. To find out more, again, go to golfsmarterpodcast.com and this time click on the link to Bird Golf. I want to take a moment to thank you for responding to my email about Golf Smarter gear and your honesty on whether or not you'd purchase it if we made it available. The subject's not closed, and I'll keep you updated as we progress. We end with our quote of the week, which is submitted by you. If you have a favorite golf quote, send an email with the subject quote to fred@golfsmarterpodcast.com. And this week's quote comes from Dan Wiley of Coshocton, Ohio. Dan writes that one of his favorite golf quotes comes from the succinct wisdom of Bobby Jones. The secret to golf is turning three shots into two. Thanks for listening to the Golf Smarter podcast. I'm Fred Green.